Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. Here, we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of professionals actively working on the front lines in the field of food addiction. The purpose of our show is to educate you, the listener, and increase overall awareness about food addiction as a disease with abstinence as the solution. Here, we talk about all things recovery. Most importantly, how to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make a change for yourself, tell others about your change, and hopefully the message will spread.
Is AA still effective in today's world? What does the research say? Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. My name is Dr. Vera Tarman, and I am your co-host today along with Clarissa Kennedy. Dr. John Kelly is the Elizabeth R. Spaulding Professor of Psychiatry and Addiction Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He is the director of the Recovery Research Institute at the Massachusetts General Hospital, the associate director of the Center for Addiction Medicine at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and program director of the Addiction Recovery Management Service. Dr. Kelly is also a former president of the American Psychological Association's Society of Addiction Psychology and a diplomat of the American Board of Professional Psychology. He has served as a consultant to U.S. federal agencies and non-federal institutions, as well as the United Nations. Dr. Kelly has published over 200 peer-reviewed articles, chapters, and books in the field of addiction medicine. His work is focused on addiction treatment and the recovery process, mechanisms of behavioral change, and how to reduce stigma and discrimination amongst individuals suffering from addiction. In 2020, Dr. Kelly published a Cochrane review evaluating the efficacy of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step facilitation interventions. The review found that AA leads to increased rates and lengths of abstinence compared to other common addiction treatments. It incorporated evidence from 27 high-quality studies involving 10,000 patients, and we at Food Junkies are keen to explore how that might apply to our community. So welcome, Dr. Kelly.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I was going to say, let's just jump into the Cochrane review, but we like to get a little bit of a personal side. What was it that initially sparked your interest in studying specifically about the 12-step programs?
The 12-step programs are the top most utilized recovery support service in the world, and they're often linked to by our clinical services. When I entered the field 30 years ago, there were some people doing research on these resources, but not that many from a rigorous standpoint. So I thought it was a no-brainer to look at the utility, the clinical and public health utility of groups like AA and other groups and how they can maximize the benefits that patients obtain from treatment, and also independently how people can just utilize these resources for free in the communities in which they live without going to treatment, which is also very common. Myself and my colleagues were very interested in actually getting very rigorous data and subjecting these resources to the same scientific scrutiny that we would any other intervention, given their prevalence. So that's what we wanted to do.
How did you get the Cochrane Review interested? How did that process happen?
Yeah, the Cochrane Review, some of the listeners may be familiar with it, some may not. The Cochrane system, the Cochrane Library, is an international review system. It's considered to be the gold standard of kind of clinical science for scientific rigor. So if something gets into the Cochrane Library, it means it's very thoroughly vetted from a scientific rigor standpoint, and also the results are to be taken to heart, as it were, in terms of the degree of confidence that you can have in the results from these kinds of reviews. So they're considered to be the gold standard. Now, in the answer to your question, you have to apply to submit a review and protocol. So we did that, and that goes out for review through the system of editors and so on and independent reviewers. That protocol that we submitted was approved back in 2019. And then we went ahead and conducted the review. There was a prior review published in the library, in the Cochrane System Library in 2006. And so this was a new review, because there have been so many studies done in the interim period between 2006 and 2020 that we needed to update it. And as you pointed out at the beginning, the We included 27 studies. There was only 8 studies in the prior review. So there's a big multiplication of studies, as well as rigorous scientific studies that have been conducted in the interim. So we wanted to update it and include all of those new studies.
This is a big question. Do you want to give us some key findings of the review regarding the efficacy of AA? Let's just start with that. Does it work?
Yeah, the answer is yes, it does work. And not only that, it does very well when you compare it to other kinds of clinical interventions that are treating alcohol use disorder and alcohol addiction. Most of the studies were treating the severe end of the spectrum. So what we might classify, think about as addiction cases, people who have impaired control, severely impaired control over alcohol use despite harmful consequences. And we found that on every single outcome that was included, which was any outcome basically that was reported across these 27 studies. By the way, I should back up a little bit in terms of the literature that was reviewed. We reviewed worldwide literature. So all of the clinical databases worldwide were screened for anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous or treatments designed to link patients to AA, what they call 12-step facilitation treatments. And so all of the databases were scanned and to find abstracts related to these topics. So there were something like 12,000 initial abstracts that then were whittled down to the final batch. They had to be a certain type of study. In other words, they couldn't just be correlational. They had to be experimental. Or have, if they weren't experimental, they had to have discrete comparison groups that were prospective. So they had to have distinct treatments, and then patients were followed up over time. So it had to be that kind of design. But it just so happened that the vast majority, 95% of the studies, were randomized controlled trials. So they were randomized clinical trials. These are true experiments, and this is considered to be the gold standard from a scientific rigor standpoint in terms of determining causality or answering the question that you asked long ago, which was, does AA work? Anyway, so all of these studies, the vast majority of them were, as I mentioned, they were randomized controlled trials. We included any outcome. So any outcome that was reported in these studies was recorded and reported in the Cochrane, our Cochrane review. The majority of the studies focused on things like abstinence, longest period of abstinence, the proportion of patients who are completely abstinent, intensity of use, so it would be drinks per drinking day or percentage of days heavy drinking in the outcome periods that were measured. And they were measured up through 3 years in these studies, 3 years after the initial intervention occurred. But it could also include things like quality of life and well-being. There are just no studies that reported those functional, more functional outcomes and psychological well-being outcomes. And basically, so we had about 11,000 patients across 27 studies. Some of the studies also were economic studies. So they looked at cost-effectiveness, not just effectiveness of AA and 12-step treatments, but also do they help reduce healthcare costs and other kinds of costs to society when you implement one of these treatments to link patients to, in this case, AA? So we had 5 economic studies also that were included in the review. Of those 5 economic studies, 4 of them also included clinical outcome data. One of them was purely economic. So that was the batch of studies. And we found over anywhere from a few months to up to 3 years that patients that were linked to AA, so these were alcohol patients, again, mostly on the severe end of the spectrum, when they were randomized to either receive a linkage to AA or to another kind of treatment like CBT or motivational interviewing or family therapy, patients who were linked to AA did as well on every single outcome except abstinence and continuous abstinence and remission, where they did substantially better. So they had about 20 to 60% higher rates of continuous remission across 3 years compared to patients randomly assigned to cognitive behavioral therapy or another kind of therapy. Otherwise, they were similar in terms of their outcomes, a little bit better on drinks per drinking day as well, where there were differences. It tended to favor the 12-step condition. So that is good news, given that AA is a free resource in the community. And it's very ubiquitous. So when we're talking about a very high toll in terms of disease burden, premature mortality, the CDC, for example, just reported last month an updated figure for the number of alcohol-related deaths in the United States in 20 and 21 was 180,000. That's 80% more than the overdose deaths. So we just saw the last overdose poisoning deaths from opioids and other drugs was 107,000. Alcohol is killing 180,000 now per year. So about 80% more. So when you consider the death toll, as well as the human misery and burden of disease, not just about mortality, of course, it's about other kinds of problems and big challenges that people face and their families face when someone has an alcohol addiction. The fact that we have a free, ubiquitous, effective resource in the communities in which people live is a huge gift. That's why I call it the kind of the closest thing public health has to a free lunch, because of its potential utility. The other thing just to mention, as I alluded to, is the cost effectiveness. So not only did it produce better outcomes where there were differences, particularly in terms of continuous remission, but it also reduced healthcare costs in the region of $10 to $15 billion per year for those patients assigned to the 12-step condition. So that's good news, both in terms of clinical utility as well as reducing the burden on the healthcare system.
Given this success, why is it that people are so resistant to this? What's the resistance then to AA, given these numbers, given this astounding success that you've shown? Why is the medical community not pushing this?
I think it's the quasi-religious aspect of AA makes people nervous about it, about sending patients there. The fact that it contains explicitly religious language, even though, of course, AA and 12-step organizations refer to themselves as spiritual organizations rather than religious. They're not religious organizations per se, but rather people just pick and choose their own spirituality under the auspices of a 12-step organization. And there are many, of course, many agnostic and atheists in these groups. So I think that's the main barrier, is that there is a concern about this conflating religion with kind of clinical treatment. And I think that's why I think there's some resistance, even despite the fact that there is now very clear and strong evidence in favor of their utility.
Do you think that AA is accessible to people who are non-religious?
Yeah, there's lots of research that shows that people who are agnostic or atheist do benefit from participation in AA and other 12-step groups. They're less likely to go initially because of that. So it's a barrier for some people right out of the gate in terms of attending, because they perceive it to be religious. But for those who actually attend, they do as well, who are atheists and agnostics. So you don't have to have that inclination or even be open to religious or spiritual ideas to benefit from AA. But it is a barrier for some people in walking through the door.
Do you think that AA could work for anybody and everybody, or is it more tailored to extroverts, people who like groups? Why does it work for some people and not others?
I think we've tried to look at, and many people have looked at, kind of predictors of initial attendance, predictors of engagement, predictors of retention, etc. The one clear indicator that seems to trump all the others is severity of addiction. So if you are more severely affected historically by addiction, you've got a severe clinical course, you've got big challenges because of your alcohol or other drug use. People, regardless of whether it's AA, people utilize more AA, they utilize more treatment, they tend to stick more and go for longer, because essentially they need more resources to help them. And the fact, again, it's AA, because AA and groups like AA are so ubiquitous, it makes it a good resource for people to utilize, because it's populated with peers with lived experience who know how to stay in remission, stay sober, stay in remission, and not only that, be able to handle the demands of recovery and sobriety. So without the anesthetic, how do you handle life terms, as they say, without having to resort to using a substance? And so this is the program of recovery beyond the fellowship, those two dimensions, the fellowship, the population, which accounts for the majority of the effect, is social network, which helps people to stay the course, and the lived experience, millions of years of lived experience washing around these fellowship rooms because of all the peers that are in those meetings who have that lived experience.
In the research, did you find that AA works as well for diverse populations, people with different racial, ethnic, cultural backgrounds and maybe even various lifestyles or experiences?
Yeah, we didn't look at that specifically in this review, but that has been looked at to varying degrees. So yeah, that we haven't found any differential benefits from participation, whether you're a man or a woman, whether you're a sexual minority, whether you're different of a different racial ethnic group, you tend to benefit, they all tend to benefit to the same degree. And it tends to be that young like attracts like. So if you're a Black person, you're more likely to go to Black meetings and become affiliated with Black meetings. If you're white, you're more likely to go to white meetings. If you are gay, lesbian, you're more likely to go to gay, lesbian meetings and do better there. You're more likely to get engaged by that. If you're a young person, you're more likely to get engaged by groups where there are other young people there. So there is that affiliation, birds of a feather flocking together kind of idea. That seems to be apparent. But in terms of the actual derived benefit, it's of similar magnitude. There's no difference.
Could this research that you've done on 12-step, could it be applied to other long-term recovery communities like Life Rings, Smart Recovery? We have something called Sweet Sobriety for people with food addiction, which are long-term recovery organizations of support.
I think I would answer yes to that. And now here's why, because I think the main part, the main therapeutic mechanisms through which these organizations work are very similar. I think there are three major mechanisms, that is motivation, coping, and confidence. And the key with any kind of chronic illness, which is susceptible to relapse over time, which these addictive disorders are, you need some kind of ongoing chronic recovery support service, if you will. Not for everybody. This tends to be for those who have been more severely impacted by the disorder. So people with, from a diagnostic and statistical manual perspective, people in the moderate to severe end, but definitely on the severe end, they tend to need more of these services over time to be able to stay in remission, because recovery in the early months and years for those individuals is unstable. It's more unstable because there is, you know, more impact in the central nervous system. It takes longer to recover. And also their lives have been more severely impacted. So it takes longer for their lives to get back on track. So they need more support over a longer period. Typically, on average, this is what we see. And I think groups like Smart Recovery, Life Ring, Women for Sobriety, all these other different flavors of recovery mutual help, as well as recovery support services like recovery housing, recovery coaching, recovery community centers, all these new services which have emerged in the last 30 years, designed again to address the needs of individuals after that initial period of stabilization to help them stay in recovery, I would argue that they would confer a similar benefit if people can access them and utilize them. And I think they work in similar ways. So they confer the same kind of benefits. They help to keep motivation for recovery high through reminding people. They remind people of what their life used to be like in active addiction through listening to other people. That people get reminded, whether they like it or not, they're going to get reminded. And that's, that can be a healthy adaptive reminder. It also boosts cognitive and behavioral coping skills. So they learn through the exchange of information and role modeling how to stay sober, how to handle situations which are high risk. And then the other one is self-efficacy, which is this confidence, people's faith in their ability to be able to stay in recovery for the next 24 hours or next week or next month. It tends to do all those three things. It tends to continually mobilize things. And if we know anything about addiction, it's susceptible to relapse, particularly up through this first 5 years.
Hey, Food Junkies listeners. We're just going to take a quick break here to share with you something our team thinks could help benefit your recovery with food, body, or self. Thank you again for listening.
Hey there, Food Junkies listeners. You're invited to the International Food Addiction Consensus Conference being held on Friday, May 17th, 2024 in London, UK. This informative and engaging gathering will build awareness for the growing problem of food addiction, not only for us adults, but also for children and future generations. Speakers include Chris Mantulikin, Robert Lustig, Michael Moss, Vera Tarman, Adrian Sotomoda, Erica LaFada, David Wiss, Timothy Brewerton, Anna Lemke, Nicole Avena, and Susan Pierce Thompson. But why should you attend? Because you can gain valuable insights from international researchers, physicians, clinicians, and metabolic experts. You can network with professionals and like-minded individuals and learn about food addiction and how ultra-processed foods impact the brain. You can see the latest scientific research on the addictive nature of certain foods and the clinical research in this area. Finally, you can support our international program to get food addiction recognized as a disorder listed in the ICD-11 so we can improve the food environment for future generations. We hope you'll join us for a full day of education, connection, and hope. Be sure to check the show notes for the link to purchase your in-person or live stream tickets. If you're unable to attend or view the live stream and still want to support this work, you can donate a ticket by paying for another attendee, and we'll make sure it goes to a healthcare professional, student, or member of the public who wouldn't otherwise be able to attend. Just use the link in the show notes. You can spread the word. Share our cause with your friends, family, and colleagues. The more people who know about our mission, the greater our reach becomes. You can use social media, email, or good old-fashioned word of mouth to help us raise awareness. Finally, you can donate. Every dollar, pound, or any other currency you contribute goes directly towards making this conference possible and supports the work we're doing to get food addiction recognized by the World Health Organization. Again, please be sure to check the show notes for the link. All right, back to the episode.
Now back to the show. If you have enjoyed this episode, please let us know. We love to hear from you. Kindly leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to our podcast on. We love getting feedback from our listeners.
Okay, I'm a clinician and I've been around probably as long as you have, and I've seen that the waxing and waning of AA's prevalence in the clinical community. It was prominent in all treatment centers. They're basically 12-step facilitation. And now more and more, it's moving away from that using secular tools like cognitive therapy and, of course, medication. How could you see AA continually being, because it is so powerful, how can we coach it to be more palatable?
That's a good question. I think it's important for people to recognize its utility. And I think that's why we are talking today, of course, is to highlight the fact that there is strong evidence now, clear and strong evidence that AA works. It works as well or better to keep people in remission over time. We should not throw away AA or 12-step organizations. I think that would be a huge public disservice to downplay what we now know to be an effective and helpful intervention that can help millions of people for free. And this is, like I said, it's a free lunch from a public health perspective, AA and 12-step organizations. Now, the good news is that there are now different flavors of recovery supports, as we were just talking about. So it should be not either or, but both and. So we should be laying out the menu of options for people, just the same way that, you know, not everybody likes vanilla ice cream. Different options, different flavors of recovery supports that can attract and engage more people. If people are turned off by religion or spirituality, they can try another one of these pathways, a life ring or another pathway, another service that can hopefully attract and engage those individuals. So the good news is we've got more of them. The other ones still need to grow. They're nothing like as big as 12-step. 12-step has been going for such a long time, of course. But I think from a recovery services options perspective, we've got more than ever before different varieties of recovery pathways that people can hopefully find out about and be able to find one that fits for them.
So your Cochrane review, it really gives the scientific legitimacy that is required by the clinical world. And the YouTube 15-minute piece on that, I show to every one of my addiction classes. And I can't tell you how many people at the end will go, you know what, I was really against AA, but I might rethink this. Just that simple tool makes a big difference. And I have to thank you for that. Just on that alone, I'm really impressed with that. But anyway, part of the problem is that we don't have enough research like that. So you did a nice compilation. Could you see that we could do more research to continue to validate this process and keep it in the eye of the clinicians?
Yeah, I think, and thank you for that. I think that there's a lot to be said, isn't there, for video, just being able to summarize it in a video. People will watch a video rather than read a 2,500-page paper. But that was a nice distillation of the results in that video. So I'm glad you're showing it. We have a big study right now going on right now, looking at the mechanisms of behavior change in AA. We're just finishing it up in Canada and the US. So again, we're trying to find out more about how AA works and for whom, when. So to understand more about who in particular may benefit or not benefit over what period and what the mechanisms are at different points in the recovery process. We know early on, for example, that people need a lot of learning. They need to learn skills. They need to learn the skills of recovery. How do you navigate high-risk situations without picking up a drink or a drug? How do you do that? So early on, there's a lot of cognitive behavioral skills learning and rehearsal and deployment in high-risk situations. So people are learning how to stay sober. Once they get past that kind of first year or two, it's a different paradigm. Oftentimes, people know how to navigate high-risk situations. They've often created a lifestyle which is supportive and conducive to long-term recovery. Then it becomes more about meaning and purpose. What's my life about? What am I going to do with my life now that I'm in recovery, in remission, and I'm stable? And that, so in other words, for folks who reach that point, the mechanisms shift. In other words, the way that AA or groups like AA help people changes over time. And so we're understanding more about the dynamic, in other words, these dynamic aspects of recovery as it pertains to AA, but also to other recovery support services too, how people utilize these resources to be able to stabilize from a deadly life-threatening illness and then live a good life. And essentially, as some people would say, be better than well.
Now, rumor has it that you are thinking of doing another Cochrane review on smart recovery. Is that one? If so, when is it coming out?
Not on smart recovery, just because there aren't enough studies to do one yet on smart recovery. There are a few small studies. We've done one actually on smart recovery ourselves here, a 5-year study looking at smart recovery. But there are just too few studies at the moment to do Cochrane review. You'd need a certain number of high quality studies. We're just not there yet. But there has been one systematic review, which I was an author on, conducted by colleagues in Australia, who basically concluded that there was only preliminary data yet on smart recovery. But again, I would argue that for people who select into smart recovery, they will do as well as people who select into AA because it fits with their goals. In other words, it's not so much about relative efficacy as it is about the fit. And the metaphor I often use in this regard is a bit like a fitness center. And the question I pose to audiences is, do fitness centers help keep people fit? And the answer, of course, is yes, they do. If you go to the fitness center and you work out regularly, and you're going to get fit, physically fit. Now, fitness centers know this. And so when you walk into a fitness center, you don't just see 40 cross trainers and that's it, right? Now, it's true. It's a fact that if you work out on a cross trainer, you will get physically fit if you do that regularly. But not everybody wants to use a cross trainer. So rather than 40 cross trainers, they've got 40 different classes. They've got swimming pools. They've got courts. They've got all kinds of racket sports. They've got all kinds of physical fitness equipment. Why? Because they want to attract and engage more people into the process of physical fitness. Even if you're just metaphorically and literally dipping your toe in the water of the swimming pool, they want to get those people in the door. So they start on something that's attractive and engaging to them. The way that recovery support services has gone is similar to that, is that we've said, now it's true, AA works. It's like the cross trainer of recovery. Maybe it is the cross trainer of recovery, gets people fitter for recovery than anything else. But if people aren't willing to get up on the cross trainer, then we lose those folks. So how do we provide more kinds of things that can get them fit for recovery? So offering more options, more classes, if you will, on the recovery spectrum of how do we get people in the door of recovery, getting them involved in something that may be attractive and appealing, just in the same way as fitness centers utilize everything and anything to get people into the process, get them started on some kind of fitness journey, get them people started on a recovery fitness journey, if you will.
Oh, I love that. And I think you're really speaking to the many pathways of recovery. And I want to shift gears here a bit. And as the director of the Recovery Research Institute, I'm curious, What are your thoughts on harm reduction? And why do you think in the field, I am also a clinician in the field, and it's often like harm reduction versus abstinence. And any thoughts on why that might occur as well?
I think historically, when you actually look under the hood of harm reduction and recovery, they're really on the spectrum. They're really on the same spectrum from pre-contemplation to action to maintenance. And this is where I think harm reduction is critically important, because we need to keep people alive for them to get into recovery. And so we need to do whatever we need to do to enable that and facilitate that and promote that, of course. I think ideologically, there's a bit of an ideological camp at the extremes of both of the, as there often is in many things in life and society, of course. And I think the same has become true in terms of harm reduction. It's not either or, in my view, but rather both are incredibly important paradigms. And so we should embrace everything and anything that we can use to save people's lives and then help them move towards better health and functioning.
And I think I've definitely heard you speak before about recovery trajectories and what somebody who first enters recovery looks like and why that might validate the need for harm reduction, because it's not this one and done, I decide to stop and I'm finished. So can you share with our audience a bit about what is the actual recovery trajectory for someone who decides to stop you?
There are various paths. The good news is this: overall, when you zoom out to 30,000 feet, the good news is when you either reduce or stop use completely, your life's going to get better. It's not really a shock. But to the extent that you are harming yourself and your functioning by taking alcohol or other drugs, then when you reduce that exposure, your life's going to get better, because that becomes the cause of the problem. Of course, it was once the solution, but now it becomes a new problem. And this is the nature of how things change, of course, in addiction. And interestingly, I always point this out, is that the four main reasons why people use alcohol or other drugs is to feel good, to feel better, to do better. In other words, performance enhancement, or because other people are doing it. And then I often pose the question, what are the four main reasons why people stop using alcohol or other drugs? It's to feel good, to feel better, to do better, or because other people are not doing it. So they're the same four reasons, except that once upon a time, the train left the station and you're going on this fantastic journey and everything's really exciting. The train at some point becomes derailed and it crashes and burns and you want to get off. And so what starts really well ends badly. And this is the nature of addiction, of course. So these different trajectories, when we zoom out, we see people's lives improving year over year when they are in recovery, even controlling for age. So when you take a 40-year temporal view of somebody anywhere from a few weeks up to 40 years in recovery, their lives are getting better and better, even and happier, and their quality of life is improving year over year when they stay in recovery. That's the good news. In particular, the first 5 years, steep improvements in quality of life and functioning. And it shallows out thereafter, but it still increases. Now, what we also know, and I think you alluded a little bit to this, and the segue was from harm reduction, not everybody stops use of all substances who have a substance use disorder. Interestingly, we find people with the most severe problems who've been most severely addicted and impaired, those individuals tend to abstain completely from everything. I think that's our kind of classic default paradigm, is you've got to quit everything and stop me. That is true, but only for the most severely addicted individuals. What we find also is people at the lower end, less severe end of the spectrum, who have not suffered as greatly, have not been as impaired, they may stop their primary substance, which has caused them most of their problems, but they may use a secondary substance or even a behavioral that may have a gambling or sex or food or exercise that may be a kind of compensatory behavior that enables them to cope in a kind of a harm reduction, you could argue, is a kind of a harm reduction kind of way. Whereas they might stop their primary substance like alcohol or cocaine or whatever it's been, because that has been a clear standout in terms of causing them more problems. But those individuals, too, improve in their functioning and well-being. Not as much as people who are abstinent, but it does significantly improve. And individuals who are in remission, but who are still using, their remission status is less stable, as you might guess. So people who are completely abstinent if you look at them 2 years later, they're much more likely to be in remission than people who are in remission but using a little bit. So a kind of more of a stable path is abstinent remission, but not everybody chooses to be completely abstinent. But again, those individuals, hooray for those individuals, because they're making progress, they're changing their behavior and hopefully feeling better. And also the people who care about them also feel better that they're making progress. So it's all good news. It's just different pathways for different folks over time. And those people who maybe are using a little bit, they tend to migrate towards abstinence over time. People tend to end up abstinent more often than not.
What about those people who have had continuous abstinence for some time and then decide, you know what, I think I might try to moderate a little bit? You've had some commentary about how that person may not actually be at the same risk. So maybe it's possible that they could moderate. What's your impression about that?
It depends. It depends, again, on who that individual is we're talking about. It's hard to, again, it's the dilemma of averages. Within these average groups, of course, there's a lot of variability. What we do know is that when people abstain for months or years or even decades, if they are severely impaired and addicted when they stop, the speed at which they will regress back into the same kind of pattern as they exhibited when they stop, even though that can be many years ago, is much quicker if they've been severely addicted than if they've been less severely addicted. So there's something about this kind of overlearned behavior or change in the human brain or central nervous system, which is reactivated quite quickly when people who have been abstinent start using again. It's slower among people who have had less severe problems. And maybe 20 or 30 years later, if they start to use again, they may not encounter any problems. And this has also been documented. But on the severe end of the spectrum, it seems to be that once you've been severely addicted, return to any use results in re-addiction as opposed to moderated use.
Dr. Kelly, I'm wondering if I've heard you speak about this before, that it can take 7 to 8 years for somebody to get one continued full year of abstinence. And I find that to be such a self-compassionate fact about recovery, that sometimes in the space, it feels like we're not allowed to practice recovery and get new skills. And I really feel like that speaks to it. So can you talk about that research? And then also after you get the 1 year of abstinence, what does it look like maybe 5 years post that one first year?
Yeah, it is rarely a one and done. Again, for the more severe end of the spectrum, it tends to be a process of change. People don't wake up one morning and snap into recovery, but rather there is a gradual accumulation of more and more problems, and people are trying to cut back, control, manage their life while they are still using and try and find ways to moderate that. And indeed, one of the hallmarks of addiction, of course, is repeated attempts, failed attempts to cut down or stop despite harmful consequences. So this is the very nature of the condition, is that people try to put the brakes on that locomotive, but they find it increasingly difficult to do. And it can take, as you mentioned, Clarissa, what we have found in prospective studies in these addicted samples, so these would be the more severe end of the spectrum, it can take about 7 to 8 years to get that first year remission after people start seeking help. The good news is, after people start to seek help, whether that's from AA, mutual help group, treatment, they start to get longer and longer periods of abstinence. So they might have, and it takes about 4 to 5 treatment episodes during this 8 year period before they get that first year of full remission. After each episode of treatment or mutual help involvement, they tend to get longer and longer periods of abstinence. So it's a kind of a learning process. So people learn along the way what they can and cannot do, what the demands of recovery require. And so people will be punished. A relapse is punishing. It's not enjoyable. It might be for that first night or the first couple of days or the first week, but ultimately it's a punishment paradigm in the end. As again, I mentioned, things go well, but then they go badly. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. To quote Charles Dickens, it's a tale of two cities. But it's a learning process, in other words. People get longer. So they find out what they need to do to stay on the path of recovery. until they eventually get that first year of remission. And that can take about 8 years in these addicted samples in adults. Now, as you mentioned, Clarissa, also in the aftermath, and this is, I think, where we began today's conversation about the need for ongoing recovery support services, whether that be AA or other groups or other recovery support entities. They're very important for these individuals who are on the severe end of the spectrum, because it takes, even after that first year of full sustained remission, which in and of itself is a big accomplishment, it takes another 5 years on average before the risk of meeting criteria for an alcohol or other drug use disorder in the following year drops to the same level as the general population. So it takes about another 5 years of continuous remission before you're at no greater risk of meeting criteria for one of those disorders in the following year until it meets the same level as the general population. So that's quite a long time, 5 years. And this is why I think we are starting to, we've talked about this for a long time in the field, haven't we, about the fact that these tend to be chronic conditions, they are susceptible to relapse, but we haven't really orchestrated, implemented our services along those lines. We've tended to provide short acute care treatments, detoxification, stabilization, and typically 12 weeks of treatment.
Just getting back to AA, what do you think then about the whole focus on day one, day 30, day 90, where you get lots of reward? But if it's such a chronic relapsing condition, isn't that discouraging for the person who's relapsed because they're still in that first 7 years of their trying?
The good news is, I think, I don't think it's discouraging. I think what the research shows is that if you keep trying, you are going to get off the launch pad and you're going to get out into orbit. You are eventually going to be out into orbit in a good way. I don't mean orbit in the sense that you don't have that gravitational pull of addiction pulling you back, that you need relatively little energy to keep you in orbit than you do to get off the launch pad, of course. It's encouraging, I think, that people make longer, they have longer and longer periods of remission and recovery as they keep trying. And most people, of course, we know about 70% of people who meet criteria for an alcohol or other drug use disorder will achieve full remission. That's the good news. So most people do actually achieve remission, but it can take a while to get into sustained remission and recovery. But you just keep trying. You keep trying, dust yourself down and move forwards, get the help that you need, and you're going to get there in the end. That's the most likely outcome, that you are going to get into remission and stable recovery, even though it can take a while to do it.
I'd like to just turn this over to food addiction. In the food addiction world, I think we've got 12-step groups around food. Have you got any comments about that? Do you think that it would work as well? Have you seen any research along those lines?
I have not seen much research in the area of food or food addiction. There just have not been hardly any studies. There have been some qualitative studies, some dissertation work has been done in that area, but I have not seen any clinical trials looking at the utility. But I can see the same paradigm working, because again, food addiction, food disorders are same as, you know, gambling, sex, other kinds of things which are all affected, mediated through that reward pathway in the brain. Again, it's a very similar paradigm, may not be identical. You don't have the kind of neurotoxicity that you have with alcohol or other drugs affecting the central nervous system, but you still have this neuroadaptation process going on in the brain as a function of use of certain types of food that can change the brain and lead to greater tolerance, a similar paradigm to as you would see in other drugs. And so I think when we look to the people who suffer from this themselves, as was found with AA and other groups, they know where it's at. They know what they need. And so the fact that there are so many of these groups that have popped up to address this problem means there's definitely something in it. There is something therapeutic and helpful in it. Otherwise, people would not waste their time creating these things, going back day after day, week after week, month after month, because they know, again, these things are susceptible to relapse and reinstatement as other kinds of chronic illnesses.
So we have a conference in May coming up, and it is really a consensus statement for trying to get food addiction, maybe it's ultra-processed food addiction, in the international classification of diseases. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on what might be next steps for us going forward, knowing what you know about the recovery research, maybe some areas areas we might need to explore more, or if you think this is going to be, we're going to face a lot of barriers trying to get this recognized.
I think the, again, when you talk about, we get caught up sometimes in our language and terminology and concepts and constructs. So when you are talking about addiction, what do you mean is the question I would ask. What are you talking about when you say addiction? Now, typically there is, we all tend to use the term addiction in a generic way. I'm an addict, I'm an addiction problem, I've got an addiction problem. But there is a specific technical meaning, as I've been alluding to this morning, regarding addiction. That is to say, it's typically at the severe end of the what we now classify as a substance use disorder spectrum that has mild, moderate, and severe subcategory in the category itself. Now, the addiction, we tend to, someone with two symptoms, we wouldn't necessarily classify as addicted. They may be on a path towards addiction, but they're not yet addicted. And whereas someone who meets for 10 out of 11 symptoms probably is addicted. In other words, they have got that classic phenotype of impaired control over use despite harmful consequences. That's really the sine qua non of the syndrome. And so you'd have to delineate, in my view, look to see how food addiction, to use the general term food addiction, how it maps on to those 11 or ICD symptoms, if you choose that ICD 11 or whatever it is, 10 or 11, take a look at those and look to see how well it maps on to those. And would you have mild, moderate, and severe, like in DSM? Would you have the same kind of thing? Is there kind of symptoms of withdrawal and tolerance? Do they still apply? Or is there continued use of food and what kinds of food, despite harmful consequences, et cetera? It tends not to be broccoli that people are eating, but rather other kinds of high fructose corn syrup infused things and high fat foods, high salt, those kinds of things which are very appetizing and have very high caloric density, which again, it gets into that reward pathway in the brain and become very habit forming. And there's no doubt in my mind is that people can really get hooked on those particular foods and look for those foods that are high density sweets and fats, and they have consequences because of it that can't seem to stop.
That's awesome. And I want to respect your time. So we just have a signature question to close up with. And I would say, if you were going to tell a younger version of yourself something about addiction or recovery, what would you say to them?
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. You mean a younger researcher myself or?
Yeah, just a younger version of yourself. What would you say to little John Kelly about addiction and or recovery that maybe might have made a difference to him at that stage?
Well, I would say it's not as simple as it seems.
That's amazing. That's brilliant.
Not as simple as is that there's, in some ways it's simple, but it's not what you think always. And to be careful and learn a lot more about it before you come to your conclusions. I think a lot of people have their opinion about addiction, what it is and how to best address it. But take your time, educate yourself about it. And before you form, again, I guess this could apply to any area of life, couldn't it? That we all like to have opinions on things without the information to really inform those opinions. But I think take the time, I would say to myself, take the time to really learn about it. I think that applies to a lot of areas of life that I'm very quick to judge on, but not well equipped to do so, really. But we all like to have a... So I think I would say that to myself, take your time and understand it before you form an opinion about it. And of course, education and training really helps us to have a better approach and a more modulated, fine-grained approach, more personalized approach to help people, because we know that, again, we have this single category of substance use disorder, but there is huge variability and also different phenotypes. We haven't been able to identify robust kind of phenotypes within that broad domain, but undoubtedly there are different types of addiction that people respond to different treatments to address. And this is what we still need to be able to figure out, is that which type of person, which type of addiction responds best to which type of intervention.
That sounds
right amazing. Now, the best we can do. Yeah, right now, the best we can do is a bit like the fitness center analogy, is lay out all the different things out there that people could get involved in and let them select and pick the thing that is best fit for them. And I think that gives us hope in the meantime that people will find something that will match, will be a good match for them.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kelly, for being here today. It's been an honor to spend this time with you.
Likewise, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us this week on Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. Make sure to join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life Support Group, I'm Sweet Enough. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or Stitchers. That way you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Don't forget to pick up your copy of Dr. Tarman's book, Food Junkies, which is available on Amazon. If you have any additional questions, both Molly and Clarissa are food addiction professionals and work one-on-one with clients. You can find their websites and email addresses in the show notes. Be sure to tune in every Friday when our new episodes drop. As Vera loves to say, the power is ours.